hay struck me as being even more laborious than killing the dead, especially if being a working girl meant a lot of swooning. Annabelle swooned at least once every chapter, sometimes twice. Thinking of Jackson and the things he used to smuggle me makes me think of my mother. The silence from the postmaster every time Jackson came calling, or so I thought. I touched the small packet of letters tucked in the pocket of my dress. I've been gone from Rose Hill going on 3 years, but it's only been a year since the last letter I got from my mama. The packet seems too small to hold a year's worth of correspondence. What if she gave up on me? What if she is dead? I need answers about my mama and the fate of Rose Hill, now more than ever. That is enough of a reason to find a way out of Summerland, fine town or not. I draw even with the brothel and find the doorway empty. There's no door, and the room beyond is so dark that I ain't sure there's even anyone inside. Hello? I call. Is anyone there? Come on in, sugar, says a voice from inside, dark and smoky like whiskey. My penny hasn't gone cold, and this seems like the place where I'm supposed to be. So I walk on in. The room beyond the doorway comes into focus. The haze from a trio of half-dressed ladies sitting around a table smoking cigarillos and playing cards. Along the one wall is a bar, a half-dressed Negro girl perched at the end, talking to a rough-looking fella. Behind the bar, a white man, bald and shiny, leans against the polished wood counter, eagle eye on the coarse fella and the girl. I suspect that every kind of vice and enterprising sort could imagine can be found under this roof, and I am determined that I will not let this place cow me. I zero in on the redhead I saw earlier and head straight to her. She sits next to an empty hearth in a big tapestried chair, the kind you'd find in a lady's sitting room. Ma'am, I say, bobbing a curtsy, I reckon you might be the Duchess? She puts down the book she holds, Gulliver's Travels, and fans herself with a ragged peacock feather fan. Up close, it's easy to see the layers of face paint she wears. I am. And who might you be? My name is Jane McKean. I'm begging your pardon for disturbing your afternoon repose, ma'am. But I was directed to see you about lodgings, a bath, and the possibility of some sustenance. The last two are my own additions, and I ain't sure what the standard protocol is, if there is one. But I might as well ask for the sun, moon, and stars while I'm at it. The woman laughs, showing a gap in the back of her mouth where she's lost a few of her teeth. Look at you, with those pretty manners. Wherever did they find you? At the junction of hard luck and bad times, I answer. It's something that my mama says. Used to say? Best to just not think about it. The Duchess's expression softens, and she hauls herself to her feet. I reckon I've passed through there a few times myself. Well, follow me. I'll show you where you can draw your bath and where you can sleep. As for food, you've got a couple of hours until we eat, but you're welcome to join me and my girls if you'd like. Everyone on this side of town eats down at the meeting hall. Only the respectable folks get the luxury of preparing their own food. There is a tone to her voice, and I wonder what it is that I'm missing. She leads the way up a narrow set of stairs and past a room with curtains hung as partitions. The sounds of someone visiting with one of the girls filters out of the room, and I'm very careful to keep my eyes forward, lest I see something I ain't expecting. The Duchess stops at a door at the end of the hall. The room beyond is small, with a shelf along one wall. About half the spaces are taken up with extra sets of clothing, and the Duchess points to the shelves. You girls stow your stuff there. You got anything worth a damn, you're going to want to keep it with you. There's a bunch of thieving bastards in this place. She eyes the gown I wear greedily, and I get the sense that she's including herself in that group. Makes no matter to me. She can have the dress. The only things I want are my lucky penny and the packet of letters secured in my pocket. And Tom Sawyer, of course. I've taken a liking to the little urchin, and I'd like to see where he ends up. It seems the boy is always running afoul of a pack of shamblers in the midst of his Missouri adventures, and the boy's daring do reminds me of my own exploits. I put my extra set of clothing on one of the far shelves, then follow the Duchess down a back staircase. These are the stairs you'll use. Don't come down those front stairs. Those are strictly for my girls and their clients. Negroes ain't allowed to drink in the saloon anyway, or anywhere in Summerland, strictly speaking. She leans back and whispers, "You want whiskey? You'll get your spirits from the kitchen entrance. Woman named Maybell. Don't let anyone catch you, though. They're free with the strap around here." The preacher sees to that. "The preacher?" I ask. She can't possibly mean the old man I saw just a few moments ago. He was too frail to wield anything. The Duchess nods. "Don't let that old man fool you. He's got a vicious streak. The sheriff is his son, and nothing in this town happens without one of them saying so. The preacher thinks it up, but the sheriff makes it happen. Watch yourself around the two of them." Good to know. Anything else of note regarding the sheriff and the preacher? The Duchess purses her lips for a moment before telling me in a low voice, "Sheriff lost his wife to the plague going on 3 years ago, right before the wall was completed. She was a pretty blonde thing, as sweet as he is sour. Went out to gather berries by a nearby creek and got surprised. Turned right in front of his eyes. Anyway, you want to make your life easy? Don't question his authority when it comes to the dead. He's never reasonable when the question of the undead plague is involved." I nod and file the information away for later. The stairs are impossibly narrow and cramped, and we have to walk single file. They empty out into a laundry room with a glorious copper tub in the middle. "This is where you'll wash your clothes. Some of my girls take in laundry, so if you want them to wash your things, you can ask. That tub is yours to rent for a nickel, but I'll let you use it today for free since you just been through an ordeal. You want hot water, you have to pump it into the big cistern in the corner, then light that stove right next to it. After that, turn this fancy spigot here. After you're done, pull that plug in the bottom and the water will run right out back to the trough I keep for the garden. Understood?" I nod and walk over to the contraption. I look at the copper pipes, the hand pump that brings water up out of the ground, the water heater that looks to be pressurized. "You got a way of handling the silt?" I ask, gesturing to the hand pump. The Duchess shrugs one pale shoulder. "I don't rightly know. You'd have to ask the professor. He's the one that rigged up the contraption." "The professor?" "The tinkerer. Gideon. Most of the fancy gadgets you see around town are his creation." She pulls a pocket watch out of her skirt and sighs. "Dinner is in an hour or so. I need to get the girls fed before fellas start arriving." I incline my head. "Thank you, ma'am, for the fine tour of your establishment," I say, before bobbing another curtsy. She gives me a bemused smile in return and just shakes her head as she slips through a door, off to see about her business. There's a shelf of glasses along a wall, and I grab one, twisting the handle above the spigot. Water flows out, clean and clear. I fill the glass and drink deeply. The water tastes strange, as strange as anything else in this town, but not lethal. At least not yet. The Bible has been a comfort, and one of the younger girls has even started a school for the little ones. It is such a miracle to listen to them read the scripture. Although I must admit it does make me heartsick for you, darling Jane. Chapter 21, In Which I Attend Church. After a bath, I head out to find dinner. The town ain't all that big, and it's easy to see what the Duchess meant when she said that all the girls ate together. Everyone spills out of a plain, whitewashed building with a cross hammered onto the door. The meeting hall is next to the church, but separated from the grander building by a garden of white crosses, memorials to the deceased. In the old days, it would have been a graveyard, but most sensible folks have taken to burning their dead and mounting a cross in a field or yard like these. It's just safer that way. The meeting house smells of good things, so I push aside my worry that God will strike me down when I walk through the doors. I'm too hungry to worry about my tainted soul. As I enter, every pair of eyes lands on me. Toward the back of the building are two large tables of boys and girls, all Negroes, hungrily shoveling food off tin plates. The Duchess and her girls sit at their own table near the door, plenty of room around them. Some of the girls making lewd gestures to a few rough and ready white fellas sitting at a nearby table. I don't see Jackson. More important, I don't see Lily or the Spencers, and I wonder if we made a mistake, if we got ourselves sent out here for nothing. I get a plate of a thick, hearty stew and a slice of bread from the woman at the window. My serving is about half that of the white man in front of me, my plate hammered tin instead of the stoneware. I open my mouth to complain, but I ain't given the chance.
"Keep it moving," says a high voice.
Bill stands over me, shotgun propped on his shoulder. Why's he need a shotgun at dinner? No one else is armed. The old man from the church glides up to me. He smiles, but there ain't nothing friendly about it.
"Jane, Miss Devereaux will be so happy to hear you settling in nicely."
"I got this, sir," Bill says, a quaver in his voice.
There's an air of fear about him, and after I spot the large gold cross around the old man's neck, I figured this must be the preacher the Duchess warned me about.
"No, Bill, you have other matters to attend to. It's Bible study night. Go watch the door. I won't have the whores sneaking out again."
Bill walks off. The old man still smiles, thin red lips stretched garishly over large front teeth. His eyes are watery, the brown washed out to the color of a penny. His hair completely snow white and thinning. He looks like a walking skeleton, sun bleached and pale, and I involuntarily shrink back from him when he reaches a hand out to guide me toward the back of the building.
"Allow me to formally introduce myself. I am Pastor Snyder. You've no doubt already met my son, Sheriff Snyder. While my son enforces the laws here, my purpose is to give Summerland both spiritual and moral direction. It's a task I do not take lightly, as you will see."
There's a feverish gleam to his eyes, and his wide grin hasn't left his face. I didn't even know it was possible to smile and lecture someone at the same time, but here I am.
"Miss Devereaux told me that you're a bit impulsive, and she was worried for your welfare. Told me your services were a gift from her now-deceased father, and how valuable she finds your companionship."
As we walk, the preacher keeps my right arm in a bruising grip, but I can't shake him off without dropping my dinner.
"In any case, believe me when I tell you that I understand how to deal with headstrong Negroes. In my youth, I was an overseer in what was formerly South Carolina. Tobacco fields, sometimes cotton. It was there that I came to understand the divine order that the Lord saw fit to bestow upon we men. I also learn many of your kind fail to understand this order, and I know that you can deal with obstinate Negroes as long as you remember they are, at their heart, children. Spare the rod and spoil the child, as the scripture tells us.
My penny has gone icy under my shirt, and I stop walking as the preacher stops. His eyes haven't left my face not once, and I get the feeling I'm being cataloged, like a butterfly in a collection.
I'm sure you will find that your place is a comfortable one if you make it so, Jane. God can be merciful and kind, as long as you follow his laws. But how you find your life here in Summerland is entirely up to you. Do not disappoint him, and do not disappoint me, and you will prosper. Enjoy your meal.
Preacher Snyder finally releases my arm as we pull up alongside the tables full of Negro boys and girls. Most of them are about my age, but none of them look familiar, and I wonder where they're from. I'm glad there ain't any other girls from Miss Preston's, as I ain't in the mood for any kind of heartfelt reunion. Still, I wonder where the girls Miss Preston has been feeding to Mayor Carr have gone off to. Is there more than one town like Summerland? A dark-skinned girl with tight rows of braids looks up and gives me a guarded smile.
Hi. You want to sit here?
She asks, gesturing to the empty chair next to her. I sink gratefully into the chair, my hands shaking as I set my tray down.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Jane.
Likewise. I'm Ida.
Her voice is whispery and low with the deep-throated accent of the Lost States, those places in the deep south where shamblers outnumber people. Ida keeps casting furtive glances in the vicinity of Bill and his shotgun.
So, I see you met the preacher.
I did. Charming fellow.
But as charming as the serpent in the garden. Watch yourself around him.
I nod. Bill is now looking at us a little too intently, and I decide to change the subject. How long have you been here?
Ida's expression hardens. Too long. Most of us came at the same time, shipped up on a train from the Jackson compound.
Compound? Yes'm. Ain't you never heard of the compounds?
Once, briefly.
It wasn't exactly an enlightening conversation. Mind telling me more?
Not much is known about life in the Lost States.
It's generally thought of as a place even more desperate than the Western frontier. Ida talks while I scoop up my food with my fingers, since no one saw fit to give us forks.
Well, at 10, you start your initial combat training. We have a test every year. If you fail it, they put you in the fields. But there are a lot of shamblers out there, and chances are you'll get eaten, so that's no good. At 13, you join the patrols. But if you mess up, like if you don't listen or they think you're uppity, then they'll move you to another compound. Or in our case, they put you on a train.
Not in the fields with the others?
Only the little ones work in the fields, since they need all the grown folks they can to keep the dead out. And if they can't use you, they sell you to someone who can.
Slavery is illegal, I say.
Not necessarily. They got loopholes in that there 13th Amendment. If you've been bitten by a shambler, the amendment says you're no longer human, even if you haven't turned yet, which means you don't have rights as a person anymore. And there's a reward for capturing bit Negroes, since everyone is convinced we're immune. I've seen folks testify Negroes have been bit, and then those Negroes get sold off by the compound. Same if you're a criminal, and you can guess how that goes, when white folk are the ones who write the laws.
She catches herself, then looks around and lowers her voice.
Lots of different ways to pretty up the same old weevils.
Ida looks down at her hands, wringing them something fierce. I can't tell whether she's angry or upset.
If I would have known they were going to send me here, I would have run off a long time ago.
Is it worse here? I ask, not really wanting an answer. Ida just shrugs, and a girl on the other side of her leans forward.
It ain't so bad now that they got the horse to take care of the drovers. It was worse before they had something to keep them occupied.
My stomach turns, unsettling my supper so that I have to swallow hard to keep it down.
Who lives in those houses on the other side of Summerland? I ask, since she's being so chatty.
Good white folks do. They don't eat with us. Most of the good people in the town are put over there on the southern boundary. It's safer, and it's mostly families and such. The only folks here in the town are the Negroes and the trash. The nice white folks don't even attend church with us because we might soil their souls.
I nod.
So I heard. There is a loud banging. I look toward the noise to see the preacher standing at a podium that's been set up next to the serving window. He looks out across the room, smiles his ghastly smile, and says,
gather round, children. No need to be shy. There are some new faces in the flock today, and that is a boon. God has blessed us, because a growing flock is a lucky flock. As Summerland grows, as we welcome more souls into our humble town, so does the dream of a new Jerusalem, of our own righteous city on the hill.
There's some noise as chairs are moved closer to the podium. No one bothers moving where I sit. The tables full of colored folks are farthest away from the podium, and it feels intentional. The preacher continues.
Tonight, I want to tell you the story of John, one of the first farmers to settle here in Summerland. John was a flawed man. See, when he came here to our fine town, it was the beginning of the war, before the dead walked, and John had strange notions about justice and equality and God's will. He'd come to us from South Carolina, my own home state, and he came west a man who was missing something, some vital part of the self. His father had been an overseer, and rather than follow in that man's footsteps, he fled, because John had lost his faith, you see. He couldn't understand how God could let so many live in suffering and bondage while others profited off that misery. Like the abolitionists who unleashed this sinner's plague of the dead upon us, John doubted God's will.
It takes everything I have to keep my mouth shut, my thoughts to myself. People in the crowd, mostly the white men at the tables full of roughnecks, are nodding and murmuring in assent. The Negroes just sit there. This ain't the first time they've heard this sort of story. The preacher closes his eyes and puts his hand over his heart.
And because he questioned, the sinner's plague found him one day as he plowed his field. The problem with all non-believers is they think they understand God's plan. They think God sent his son to earth to die for our sins because down past the roots, we are all sprung from the same seed. But that isn't so. The Lord God himself desires, above all things, order. An understanding of where we all fit in his church, this earth. The senseless tragedy that was the war between the states disrupted the order God had given to us by his grace. For failing to understand this law fundamental to his love, he has unleashed his wrath upon us. It was hubris to think we are all equal in his eyes, friends. Not in this world. But perhaps later in the Lord's kingdom.
At that last bit, he turns and gestures at us sitting in the back,
as though the meaning in his words wasn't clear enough. A few of the white folks, both the whores and the drovers, turned to look at us. I sank down a little lower in my chair, feeling very, very exposed. The preacher smiles, as though he knows exactly the effect of his words, and continues,
"But there is hope. You can cast off the sins of your past, and you can cleanse yourself of the curse of Ham. You can toil and labor for the good of those God has made in his image, and thereby find peace and contentment. Because that is the dream of America, and it is God's will to work hard in the role God has provided for us, to be deserving of good fortune and to prosper."
Most of the white folks in the room are nodding and giving praise. I glance around the Negro tables and realize a few of those folks are as well. That makes me sad and scared. The preacher clears his throat and shakes himself a little, as though casting aside the somber feeling in the room. He smiles widely at us, his eyes shining in the low light. The penny around my neck is frigid. That man, that false prophet, might just be the most dangerous man in town.
"Now," the preacher says, his smile unfaltering, "let us pray."
We've lost quite a few of our folks over the past few weeks, not just to Shambler attacks, but also to a group of men calling themselves survivalists. They've been riding through the countryside, stirring up no end of trouble. Too many of them are of the rough sort that used to run in the old slave patrols, riding down escapees for a few coins. If you should find yourself in the path of any of these men, run in the opposite direction. There is nothing to be gained from their acquaintance, and I fear for the Negro, should these men ever come to any real power. Chapter 22, in which I learn a tune I don't care for. The next morning we are woken early, shaken awake by someone's meaty fist.
"Time to go," the big girl says before walking away.
"Well, good morning to you too," I mutter, climbing out of my nest of blankets. I scratch at my arm as I stand. I'm pretty sure that my makeshift bed has fleas, if the creepy crawly sensation over my skin is any indication. Ida gets up and looks at me as I scratch my arm. "You're gonna need to launder them blankets," she says, pointing to my arm. "Yeah, maybe I can get one of the Duchess's girls to do it." I hate doing laundry, and a few pennies seems like a fair price for dealing with flea-infested blankets. Last night, after nearly 2 hours of listening to the preacher, I walked back to the sleeping spot with Ida. She helped me find blankets in the pile in the corner, telling me that when a girl passes, we just throw her blankets here for the next one, before showing me where to sleep. There are no beds, just blankets on the floor. Everyone squished in tight as sardines. I thought Miss Preston's was bad. But now I long for the days of hard cots and meals served with cutlery. The rest of the girls are pulling on their boots and heading out the door, so I hurriedly do the same. I barely have time to spare a thought for Catherine. Did she wake up in a feather bed, toast and coffee served on a silver service? Wherever she got to, it has to be better than this. The sound of many boots on the back stairs rolls like thunder. And as we exit the saloon, a couple of bleary-eyed cowpokes leaning against the back of the building raise their heads and curse us out. No one I'm with says anything, so I stay silent too. Once we're out on the street, we fall into two lines. The boys are pouring around the back of the general store. They must have a room above it, like we girls do at the Duchess's. No one in our group looks to be much older than 20. And I wonder if everyone here is like Ida, someone rounded up from one of the patrol schools and sent out here. I crane my neck to see if Jackson is amongst the boys, but I don't find his ochre skin anywhere. A midnight-skinned boy, tall and rangy, catches my eye and gives me a wink, but I look away before he can get the wrong idea. The sheriff comes down the street atop a large, ill-tempered-looking beast. I elbow the person next to me, a small girl from Georgia who Ida introduced as Sophie.
Is that a...
Sophie looks at me from the corner of her eye.
A horse? You for real? Ain't you never seen a horse before?
I shake my head, and I wonder what kinds of places in the Lost States have horses amongst so many shamblers. The animal is big and the color of cinnamon, with a long nose and a tail of straight hair. There's more hair along the thing's elongated neck, and its hoofed feet make a hollow clip-clopping sound in the packed dirt as it walks down the road toward us.
We ready?
Sheriff Snyder calls, and I crane my neck around. Behind me are Bob and Bill, each on a horse of his own, their shotguns slung across their saddles. They give a curt nod, and the sheriff turns his horse around and starts off toward the edge of town, the thing walking pretty fast with its long, spindly legs. The columns on each side follow at a trot, and I glance over at Sophie as I realize that we're supposed to run wherever we're going. Her face is impassive, as is everyone else's, as we're herded forward. Old Professor Gehring called Negroes livestock the night of the fateful lecture. I can't help but think of him as we scurry along. The pace ain't too fast, nothing like the wind sprints we had to do at Miss Preston's, but my boots are new, and I haven't had much to eat over the past couple of days, so even a little bit of a run feels like too much. By the time we've cleared the rickety buildings of the town and get into the outskirts of the settlement, I know that this trip is going to be brutal. The horse in front of us kicks up too much dust, and I'm still weak from the train ride, but I get the feeling that not keeping up would be much worse than a few blisters and a side cramp. We've gone about a mile at our shuffle run when one of the boys calls,
"Sheriff, sir!"
The sheriff, who is rolling a cigarette, glances back over his shoulder.
"Mm-hmm. Might we sing, sir?"
The sheriff strikes a match and lights his cigarette, then gives a curt nod. I have no idea what the whole conversation pertains to until the same boy closes his eyes and sings out,
"You get a line and I'll get a pole."
Around me, everyone responds with a chorus of, "Honey, honey,
you get a line and I'll get a pole,"
the boy calls out again, his voice strong and even. This time, everyone responds with, "Babe, babe," and then everyone sings together,
"You get a line and I'll get a pole, and we'll go down to that fishing hole, honey, oh baby mine."
The sound of that many voices raised in song brings goosebumps to my arms. It reminds me of home, the way the field hands would sing during the worst of the work, the hard things like hoeing or tilling. It was a way to make the work go faster, to take their minds off the difficult task at hand. They'd sing about far-off places and about days gone by, about silly things like peach cobbler and the devil trying to steal their soul. It was something I always felt outside of back on Rose Hill, since Mama wouldn't let me go into the fields. She always said it was too dangerous. But I wondered if maybe it was something else, like she was afraid that she could lose me to a song. I ain't sure how I feel about the need for work songs in a place like this. We sing as we shuffle along for the next few miles. Eventually, I get the hang of it, and I join in, grateful for something to take my mind off the blisters forming on my feet.
When those shamblers gather round, honey, honey, when those shamblers gather round, babe, babe,
When those shamblers gather round, swing your sight, then bring them down, honey. Oh, baby mine. Ain't no use in looking sad, honey, honey. Ain't no use in looking sad, babe, babe. Ain't no use in looking sad, shambler's bite ain't all that bad, honey. Oh, baby mine. When my eyes go shambler yellow, honey, honey. When my eyes go shambler yellow, babe, babe. When my eyes go shambler yellow, then it's time to end your fella, honey. Oh, baby mine. Swing your scythe and take me down, honey, honey. Swing your scythe and take me down, babe, babe. Swing your scythe and take me down before I turn the whole damn town, honey. Oh, baby mine. By the time we get to the end of the song, I ain't enjoying it so much.
Halt!
We all stumble to a stop. There's a cook wagon in the middle of the field. Something I've only seen from drawings about Western life. A grizzled old colored man stirs a big pot of something over a fire, and a couple of small, dark-skinned boys run to and fro as the old man barks out orders.
All right,
the sheriff calls, turning his horse around so he can look down on us.
You got 10 minutes to eat. Now get.
Everyone rushes to the cook fire, pushing and shoving to get next to the little boys who hold wooden bowls that the old man ladles some kind of porridge into. I stand back, not bothering to shove my way into the throng. Once the melee is cleared, I walk up to the front. The old man looks at me with rheumy eyes.
Ain't nothing left,
he says, scraping the pot. He manages to produce a bit of burned mush from the bottom and puts it in a bowl for the little boys to share. To me, he hands an empty bowl. What am I supposed to do with this?
Don't you sass me, Missy. I gave you the bowl because you'll need it for lunch. Now clear on out.
I blow out an angry breath and go to stand next to Ida, who is poking at her burned porridge piece in dismay. The big girl, Cora, looks at me, shoveling her porridge into her mouth with her hand.
You better learn, Negro. Them fancy manners ain't gonna keep you alive for long out here.
I watch Cora eat and feel a little ill. There are no utensils to eat the porridge, so the options are use your hands or starve. The rest of our group stampeded to the trough like hogs because they knew there wouldn't be enough food for everyone. And this is all after we were herded out to the worksite. Ida sidles up to me, her expression worried.
Watch out for Cora. She's one of his favorites, she says, eyes hooded as she watches the big girl reach into a boy's bowl and scoop out a mouthful of porridge.
You want a little?
She asks, and I shake my head. No, you eat it. I ain't all that hungry anyway. It's a lie. I'm starving, but Ida is tiny, and she looks like she needs the food more than I do.
Let's go!
The sheriff yells from his horse, cracking a whip over our heads. Everyone shoves the rest of their porridge into their mouths and forms back up into their lines, bowls clutched in their hands. Once again, we start running, our destination unclear. This time, when everyone starts singing, I don't join in. We stop a short while later, our second run of the morning much shorter than our first. The ground is flat, the sun is already hot, and the grass is high. But I barely notice any of it on account of my aching feet. My boots are laced tight, and each step is painful, blisters already forming. I don't even want to imagine what my feet look like under the leather. The sheriff turns around and gives us all a steely gaze.
Fence menders, get to your business.
About half the boys and girls run off and each pick up a spool of bobbed wire, slinging it over their shoulder before they head off to a fence line a few hundred feet in the distance, the waist-high grass parting as they move through it.
Cora is one of the fence menders. So fence mending must be easier than patrolling if what Ida said about her being one of the sheriff's favorites is true. Beyond the fence, much closer now, is the imposing exterior wall. I'm guessing that's where I'm bound.
Patrol, go get your weapons.
The sheriff points to a ramshackle-looking shed, and this time I run out ahead of the group, ignoring my throbbing feet. I am not going to fight shamblers with a bowl. I'm one of the first to the shed, Ida right behind me. When the girl next to me, Iris, I think her name is, opens the door, my heart falls. These ain't weapons. They're garden implements. There are several sets of sickles and quite a few scythes. But none of them have been cared for. The blades are rusty, the edges dull, and the pair of sickles I pick up ain't even weighted properly. No wonder the girls on patrol don't last long. I grab the sickles and march over to Sheriff Snyder. I've had enough of this. I spent 3 years at Miss Preston's honing my combat skills, refining my manners, getting an education. I ain't no flunky to be prancing around the countryside just waiting to get bit. If I'm going out against shamblers, I need to be properly equipped. Sheriff, might I trouble you for a moment? The man looks down his nose at me, and his horse snorts and paws at the ground.
Why aren't you lining up with your people?
Sir, I do believe you should know that these weapons are highly inadequate for any kind of patrol. I hold up one of the sickles and point to the curved blade. These haven't been sharpened in ages. They are rusted, and I doubt they could cut through grass, much less a shambler's neck.
Jane McKean, I realize that you are new here, so I'm going to let you go back and have one of the girls explain how things work to you.
Sir, I ain't going to need to know how things work when I'm dead from a shambler's bite. Would you please look at this sickle? I hold it up higher so that he can see what a disgrace his weapons are. Quick as a snake, the sheriff's boot lashes out, hitting me in the shoulder. I stumble backward and something hits me in the back of the head. I drop the sickles, and as I fall to my knees, someone kicks me again in the back, the boot digging deep between my ribs.
Hold there now, Bill. She's still gotta work.
I climb shakily to my feet, rage coursing through my veins. The pain is a distant throb to my desire to do a little sickle work across Bill's face. Ida runs to my side.
Don't worry, Sheriff, it won't happen again. We'll school her up right.
The sheriff says nothing, just nods and spits, missing me by only a few inches.
What is with these men and all their spitting?
Ida grabs my arms and whispers into my ear.
That right there is suicide. The sheriff is a whole lot of mean and not a lot of smart. You might as well poke a rattlesnake. Your death would be easier.
I say nothing, stealing my expression to blankness. I just pick up my sickles and storm over to where the rest of the girls gather. I'm getting out of here, but before I do, I'm going to get a little payback of my own. I trust you aren't getting into too much mischief, Jane. You are always such an impetuous child, and I genuinely hope you aren't letting your temper get the better of you. Chapter 23, in which I taunt the devil. The attack leaves me in a black mood for the rest of the day. I talk to no one, only opening my mouth to answer questions when asked. My job is to walk the top of the exterior wall. I thought the walls around Baltimore had been a sight, but Summerland's wall puts it to shame. It stands at least the height of 3 men and looks to be made of stacked mud bricks. There are bits of grass mixed in with the mud bricks to hold it together, and the wall is at least half as wide as it is tall. I asked one of the girls standing next to me, "How did they build such a thing?" She glances at Bob and Bill before answering in a low voice,
You know the story of the Pharaoh and the Israelites?
The holy book is not my favorite tome, but I know it well enough. I nod, and she continues. Let's just say this wall was built like the pyramids. Most of the builders didn't live to tell about it, and ain't no Moses come to liberate them. After that, we are split into teams and assigned sections to patrol. On the way out here, we had picked our way through an inner, double-strung barbed wire fence and the interior fence, which boasts 5 lines of wire. It's a crime that a place with such excellent defenses would have such terrible weaponry available to the patrols. Behind me, Bill's smug satisfaction radiates off him in waves, and the spot on my back that met his boot aches. More than once I imagined sinking my rusty sickles into his skull, but I don't. Instead, I shove my anger down, burying it deep, letting it temper my soul. Auntie Aggie always said the hard times make us stronger. If things continue like this, I will be nigh on invincible by the time I take my leave of Summerland. I am teamed up for patrol with the dark-skinned boy that winked at me earlier in the day. His name is Alphonse, and he seems to be a nice enough fellow, if maybe a little too chatty. After 20 minutes of him relating to me his life story, I finally tell him, I ain't interested in anything you have to say unless it's how to get out of here. He clams up after that, shooting me a few black looks when he thinks I ain't looking. The wall we walk gets more disgusting the more of it I see. On the far side, in the space between us and the rest of the world, are some dead, actual shamblers, walking around, moaning for a bite to eat, all grouped up like they're going to share a secret. There ain't a lot of them, but there's enough. The wall is too high for them to climb, but it's got some footholds in it so a person could climb down if needed. And I'm about to do so and end them when Alphonse says, We ain't supposed to kill them. Just make sure they don't try to climb the wall. What's the point of that? I asked, the sound of their wailing making me feel more than a bit stabby. Alphonse shrugged. The sheriff has this idea that killing one just attracts more of them. If you do it, you'll get in trouble, and the sheriff is quick with the whip. The sickly sweet stink of rotting corpses hangs heavy in the air, and every time the wind shifts, I gag. Me and Alphonse are walking our stretch of wall for what must be the 10th time when I hear the most god-awful blood-curdling scream. A little ways down the wall behind us, a girl has slipped into the no-man's land of the prairie. Another girl is climbing down the wall to save the girl who fell, it appears. And a knot of shamblers is already running toward the both of them, hell-bent on dinner. I turn to run to their assistance, but Alphonse grabs my arm. We ain't supposed to leave our posts. Alphonse, you any good at math? He shakes his head, and I sigh. Well, I am. 2 people with glorified butter knives ain't gonna be able to take on that many shamblers, especially when a few of them look to be new turns. It comes out in a lightning-fast bit of speech, and then I'm running full tilt along the wall. I forget my blisters, my hunger, my thirst. Everything fades into the background as I count the shamblers, note their gait. You have to kill the freshies first. They're the fastest, the smartest. The ones that have been running for a while are always slower, like a clockwork toy that just won't wind. From my observations, there looks to be 3 that are moving well. The rest of the group kind of straggling behind. By the time I get to the girls, I have a stitch in my side and my feet are screaming. But I push it all aside. I pick my way down the wall, jumping too early and dropping a sickle, nearly losing my balance when I hit the bottom. I grab my fallen weapon and pick my first target, a Negro girl wearing clothing that looks eerily like mine, and leap, sickle swinging to take the thing down. Here's the thing. If these were my sickles, my beloved, sharp, well-weighted combat sickles, they would have gone through the shambler's neck like a hot knife through lard.
But these are not my sickles. So the blade gets stuck halfway, the beast snapping its teeth at me and clawing at my arms as it tries to get free. I place my foot behind the shambler's and use my sickle to push it backward. Once it's down, I use a mule kick against the curved edge to force the blade through. The head goes rolling off down into the culvert, and the body goes still. But my kill has taken time. The other two patrol girls, whom I don't know, are grappling with the remaining two freshies in close quarters, shoving them and swinging their sides ineffectively. The rest of the pack is still 50 yards away and moving like elderly folks, hunched over and slow. If I can take down the other two, then we might have a fighting chance. I switch my grip on my weapons as I run up behind the one closest to me. I cross my arms and use a blade on each side of the neck and pull the metal through. But as I'm trying to yank the sickles through the shambler's neck, I get a good look at its face. And my heart stutters to a stop. The dead girl reaching for my throat is Maisie Carpenter. Maisie was in her last year when I got to Miss Preston's. The last time I saw her was the night of Professor Gehring's lecture, when she stood along the wall, nodding in agreement as I protested using that poor man and that professor's ill-conceived experiment. And now here she is. My penny goes cold, and the sensation is enough to snap me out of my poorly timed ruminations. I grunt and yank the blades the rest of the way through Maisie's neck. It's not as efficient as a swing, but with the rusty blades, it's the best I can do. Still, it takes entirely too much effort. In the time I've taken down two shamblers, I could normally have taken down five or six. One of the other girls finally gets her scythe up and swings it at a shambler's neck. The thing goes to the ground. It's another girl dressed like an attendant. I recognize this one as well. It's the girl that ran off, leaving Mayor Carr's wife to her fate. Looks like I found the answer to what happened to the girls assigned to the fine ladies of Baltimore. I filed the fact away for later, another piece of a puzzle I ain't sure I understand or even want to parse. I rest my hands on my knees and breathe deeply as the antique shamblers amble close enough to be a threat. I have to take care of them quickly before any others show up to see what's going on. After all, we still have a wall to climb. The other two girls stand a few feet behind me, their expressions dazed and more than a little shocked. Go on, get back up. I'll take care of these. I don't have to tell them twice. They run toward the wall, trying to find the handholds that'll allow them to climb to the top. That's the problem with walls. They don't just keep the enemy out. The remaining shamblers are practically ancient, wearing uniforms from the war, and it takes very little effort to separate their heads from their bodies. They're all extremely decayed, a few of them missing arms. One has a cavalry sword hanging from his belt, and after I put him down, I unsheath the sword and test its weight. It's a real sword, not a decoration like the major used back at Rose Hill. I ain't partial to swords. The time on the reverse is too long if you miscalculate your swing. But it's better than a couple of rusty gardening blades. I use the sword to put down the rest of the decrepit pack. The euphoria, that light-headed feeling I get after every battle, is stronger than ever, most likely because this is the first time in a very, very long time where I could have died. Another few seconds removing poor Maisie's head, another couple of shamblers, and I could be lumbering and dragging along just like them. After the last of the old dead has been dispatched, I wipe the sword off on the nearest body. I toss the sword onto the top of the wall and locate a couple of possible handholds before backing up a few steps to get a running start. I run and jump, my hand digging into the uneven spots in the wall. I haul myself up to the top, groaning from the effort, kicking and scrabbling in a downright ungainly manner. But I've managed to clear the wall, and that's a feat in and of itself. A crawling sensation tickles across my skin as I stand. That's when I see Bill, below me on the inside of the wall, his rifle trained on me. Next to me, the girls have their hands up in the air.
Put them up,
Bill says. I raise my arms over my head, sword at my feet. To the right of me, the other two girls raise their arms a little higher, hands shaking. Their eyes are wide, and they're clearly terrified. Bill stares at us for a long time. He's sweaty and unsettled, like maybe lunch didn't agree with him.
Sir, what seems to be the problem?
I ask, keeping my voice calm.
You got bit,
he says, moving the rifle from one of us to the next. I look at the other girls, one of whom has started crying quietly. Bill didn't even bother to climb the wall. There's no way he can know what went on right below it. I turn back to Bill.
No, sir, none of us got bit.
Sure, took us a bit longer to put down the shamblers than it should have on account of the poor quality of weapons we're given, but we are all safe and sound. Bill turns the gun on me, then the girl next to me, then finally the one on the end.
No, you ain't. Them shamblers bit you. Ain't no way you're coming off that wall.
By this point, Bill is yelling and gesturing, spittle flying, and I'm a little shocked at how he's gone from spiteful bully to raving lunatic. I glance at the girls to see if either of them was in fact bit, when thunder splits the humid air, warm fluid spattering my face. I turn to Bill, whose eyes are wide and surprised, and then back to the girls. The one closest to me is flat on her back, most of her jaw missing, eyes wide and staring. A deep sadness rips through me, followed quickly by anger. I didn't even know her name. I whip back to Bill, who is now frantically chambering his next bullet. My anger loosens my tongue, and I drop my arms and bend down to grab my sword, gesturing at Bill with it.
What the hell is the matter with you? All you had to do was look at her arm. What kind of bastard just goes around shooting people?
But Bill can't or doesn't hear me. He lets out a frightened squeal as his eyes go wide, staring at the girl on the end. She's dropped her head and she's starting to shake. The full body shudder of someone turning. A low growl comes from her throat, and Bill hastily raises his rifle. The shot goes wide, but it gets the girl's attention, and her head snaps down, yellow eyes locked on Bill. I bring the sword up and through her throat, hard and fast. The blade does the job. Her body falling on the shambler side of the wall, her head tumbling the other way. Bill is frozen, and so I climb down the wall, grabbing what handholds I can, but mostly sliding. It takes a good while, and my temper is hot as I make my way, sword in hand. The dark cloud has settled over my thoughts once again, and I'm only half aware of what I do. I march up to Bill where he stands, wide-eyed. His joints finally loose, and he tries to point the rifle at me, barrel shaking. I knock it to the side in one motion. He's all out of shots anyway. I point the sword at him, the rusty tip only a few inches away from his nose, the blade dripping the poor girl's lifeblood in the space between us. I'm sad and angry and a whole host of other feelings, but mostly I'm fighting very hard not to kill Bill.
You just murdered an innocent girl, you cowardly bastard. All you had to do was check their arms. How hard is that?
Bill just stares at me.
Say something, you sad sack of manure. Give me a reason not to take your head off.
Bill says nothing. He looks away, shaking. I want so much to end him here. To vent my anger and frustration and fear in a single swing of a rusty cavalry sword. But I don't. I take a deep breath and wipe the blood off on Bill's shoulder before I prop it on my own. If I kill him, I have no doubt that the sheriff will execute me while that no-good pastor and most of the town looks on in judgment. And I ain't fixing to die just yet. If you point a gun at me, you better use it. Because next time I...